Hello, and welcome to this very special episode of The Hopeless Romantic. I'm Amanda Jean, and my co-host Austin Chant and I broke from format a little bit to talk about the writing and editing process of his book, Peter Darling, which is about an adult Peter Pan returning to Neverland. I'm one of the editors on the book, and basically what we did was, in three separate recording sessions, sat down and talked about some of the changes we made, some of the challenges we were facing, like tight deadlines, and tried to give a relatively non-spoilery, although definitely there are spoilers in this, and if you haven't read Peter Darling, you should stop, turn around, and go read it. Came out this February 15th, along with the other stories in the My Dearest Enemy collection. So go check those out too. They're all my book godchildren and I love them. Because Austin and I work so closely together on THR, it was kind of a no-brainer that we would record this episode, and I hope it's illuminating, and we're both really proud of it, I in my honorary godparent role as one of the editors. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to 2016 Austin and Amanda.
So, hello Amanda, we're in the past.
This is coming to you live from the end of October. I'm at a point now in the life slash editing process where I have no concept of time, so.
So this is, it might as well be 2017 right now.
It could be 2018. Yeah.
It isn't. It's 2016, and right now I have the manuscript. We're in the process of handing it back and forth, and I am currently working on content edits that are going to be fairly major rewrites to the book. I am anticipating adding 10 to 15K in this pass, and I've already cut over 5K from the book just right off the bat. So it's definitely a big overhaul that I'm very happy about. Do you want to talk about a little bit about what editing the book was like?
Yeah, for background on Peter Darling that you may not have gotten from our intro that we record in the future, I had an idea for a dual Enemies to Lovers and Friends to Lovers call, and LT3 did it, and Austin was originally going to do a completely different manuscript that got shelved because it was not cooperative, as I'm sure authors can relate to. And then one day he just sort of came home and was like, what if I just wrote Peter Pan, but like, it was Peter
gay.
Hook, and it was gay, and Peter was trans, and Peter was Wendy, and I was like screaming, you need to write this now. And so he basically could have turned in 500 pages of just filth, just awful garbage that he pulled up from the sticky floor of his subconscious, and I probably would have sent the contract for it. The good news is he didn't do that.
Mind you, I did say, I remember these words. I am going to write something that is under 20,000 words long and or like barely 20,000 words long. And I'm basically just going to retell Peter Pan, but like aged up and not weird, where Peter's trans and it'll be sexy and he'll date Captain Hook and that will be it. It'll be good.
You were lying.
A lie. A fucking lie.
All of that was a lie. I kind of knew it at the time, too, but I was sort of like smiling and nodding. A benevolent force.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to tempt fate by telling you you were a filth liar. So upon opening the manuscripts, I'm actually going to call this out specifically because it will not appear in the final version of the manuscript, but you have a lovely opening line that I'm making you trash and throw in the garbage. I opened it up and I was like, wow, this is beautifully written. Of course, Austin brought his A game to
My
this
gay
manuscript.
Game.
Your gay game.
Hey! That was a horrible audio spike. I am so sorry.
Who are we? What are we?
Anyway.
So I opened it up and immediately was, I wouldn't say relieved, because I know that Austin can write quite well, but you're never really sure what to expect when you open up the gay Peter Pan book, especially one that he wrote in what appears to be a fugue state.
It was, I wrote that book, let's see. I know I started it, I had meant to work on my story for My Dearest Enemy starting in May. I had planned to be plotting it and doing an outlining process that I like to do where I script scenes ahead of time before I write the prose. I intended to start that in May, and then I got really swamped with college and couldn't start working on it until June. It was due end of July. But I was like, oh, that's fine, I'll just start at the beginning of June. That didn't happen for a variety of reasons. I didn't wind up really getting to start on the idea before Peter Darling until late June, at which point I discovered that it was not a enemies to lovers story at all and was just a miserable train wreck. Just threw it to the wind, basically. And then I was like, I can write a fairy tale. Surely I can steal a plot from a fairy tale and just do that.
Remember your list of potential fairy tales to rip off?
I made a list of every fairy tale that you could turn into an enemies to lovers story, which I still intend to plumb those other depths at some point. But I was like, I'm going to start on this. I started it, the first draft, on July 11th.
It was due July 31st.
Yeah, and wrote 40,000 words.
Changed a lot of its conception along the way, too. It wasn't
it evolved
fully formed
violently.
States. Yeah, much like Peter.
Yes.
It was a painful, painful process. So immediately after Austin sent me the manuscript and I read through it, I knew that it was great and I knew that I wanted to contract it, but I also knew that it was wildly uneven in terms of tone and that there were things I wanted to see fleshed out and things I wanted to see toned down. And here is the first of probably 800 times I call out Austin's fondness, obsession,
anticipation.
Patience. I hope someone quivered. So we all kind of know that if you are a kid who grows up loving villains, especially queer-coded villains, you're going to think you're potentially going to think that Captain Hook is fabulous, right?
Yeah.
Just the curls, the stupid outfits, the hook itself, just the ostentatious, ha ha ha. Pirate nature lends itself to a lot of really good queer campy villainy.
I may have been somewhat inspired by that.
A little bit. There are some really beautiful, luscious descriptions of outfits in Peter Darling, and I'm really curious to see by the final product, which is, I assume, when we're going to do the second half of this episode, I'm kind of curious to see which ones we'll fight over and we'll make it into the final draft.
Single one of them.
No.
To be fair, I've already cut two.
Okay. You're doing the Lord's work.
Yeah. But I did add in another one, so, you know.
One of my comments to Austin in the document was just, I see you've restrained yourself when he managed to concisely describe an outfit in less than a paragraph. I think it was a sentence or two.
Oh, it was three sentences. I found that one. I really didn't restrain myself. I don't know why you're giving me this much credit. It was a full three-sentence description of an outfit, as opposed to the ones that are like two paragraphs long. My favorite was when I went back to, because I did a reading from Peter Darling at Gay Romance Northwest, and I had to go back and find an excerpt, which going back through it, having not had the chance to edit it, was an exercise in agony. I found the worst description in it, and this was before Amanda had finished, and I knew she hadn't seen it yet, and I was just like, oh god. It's like a full 8 to 10 line paragraph description of an outfit, and then there's a pause in the middle, and then the paragraph after the pause continues to describe the outfit for another full paragraph.
I like that you gave the audience a breather.
I was just like, what the fuck are you doing?
Conscientious. That just
shows, again, why did you
keep
going?
The fugue state that you wrote this in, where you were just like, the things that matter to me are Hook's outfits and Peter's rage.
Peter's rage, Peter's sad boy monologue, Hook's outfits, and Hook being snarky.
Hook living his best gay pirate life, frankly.
Yeah.
So in the draft that I edited, which is now a dead draft, it doesn't exist anymore. It is currently being molded into something new and better and stronger.
Dead draft, don't eat. Don't read.
Don't read. There was a lot of cool stuff in it. I had some concerns that it just was tonally weird and uneven. And the writing style changed. And some of that was getting more comfortable with Peter's voice and Peter's emotions. Because you may notice this, readers who have read Peter Darling in the future, that Peter is a very multifaceted and mercurial sort. He's hard to nail down, and his POV is one that is easy to fuck up, unbelievably. Austin never fucked it up, but there were places where I was like, I have no idea what's going on in his head. And that's not always what you want in this story.
Peter was kind of a weird character to write because I always had a sense of him. I always had a sense while I was writing it of where he was at, but not always a sense of how to actually convey that outwardly, even though it was in his POV. Just for some reason, I had like an intuition of what was going on, but sometimes expressing it was just, I guess he says this to portray that. So it was not a surprise to me that when Amanda was going through it, she was kind of like, what is going on in his head? What the hell is he feeling?
I think it's another version, another symptom of the way that you write emotional arcs. And it feels like the way that you write is to sketch out the broader beats, but leave the others unfinished, at least on the first pass. Because if you'll recall, we had a kind of similar discussion during the edits for Coffee Boy. Okay, the beats are here, but feel like there's a veil between you and the character. When they're the POV character and it's like an emotional note of the story, you need that connection, even if you don't relate to it. Like, Peter's a pretty singular character in some ways, because he is out of myth. You encountered that in part because your conception of the story changed, and also just you kind of write that way. You go back and fill in the details later, and unfortunately with the quick turnaround we had on you finishing the first draft, you didn't really get a chance to go back and connect those dots.
This is very much how I write, is I have a very amorphous but very strong sense of who a character is, and I'll write to that, but it takes somebody else reading it over and being like, I don't get what this person is doing here, before I'm aware of all of the places where I have kind of skimmed in my head. With Coffee Boy, with Kieran, like, it was making him an asshole from the reader's perspective, because to me, I understood why he was doing everything very clear in my head, what parts of his persona were defense mechanisms, and where he was acting out sadness or grief or hurt. But that was not always clear at all to the audience. And so it was very helpful to me to have you as an editor, because you were like, look, Kieran just seems like a jerk for no reason.
An unprofessional jerk, which was the thing that bothered me more, I think.
Yeah, you're like, he is behaving horribly as a worker.
I'd fire him.
Yeah, not because he's trans like he thinks, but just because he's being a piece of shit. And I was like, yeah, that seems true.
This needs to be clear that this is a preemptive strike against bullshit, not just bullshit on its own merit. That happened here too. Peter is an interesting and frequently very unlikable character in Peter Darling, and his interactions with others. I think part of that was because the main characters in Peter Darling are, you know, Peter, Hook, Tink, and the Lost Boys. And the Lost Boys to Peter are just sort of playmates. They're not really fully fledged people with agency to him, and the pirates aren't either. So the only people that he can really have an equal discussion with are Hook, and I guess to a lesser extent Finn, because Finn challenges
Finn's name
him.
Isn't Finn anymore
shitting.
By the time this comes out.
Well, you know what?
Leave Finn out of this. Who cares about Finn?
Finn, who is soon to be someone else, will reveal it in the second half. fucking fuck you. Pick a name for that motherfucker.
I think his name is Ernest. We'll see if I'm right in 6 months.
All right. Ernest.
I know.
The importance of being Ernest and not Finn.
Yeah.
and Ernest to a lesser degree. He's basically living his id fantasy, and that means he's super narcissistic and self-involved. So you can't have scenes that humanize him with the other residents of Neverland, because Peter doesn't really see himself as having any equals. So there, I couldn't even do the thing that I did in Coffee Boy, which was like, give Kieran a friend. Like, come on, man. He spends most of his time hanging out with his coworker slash boss, that one of whom he is frustrated by and the other one he wants to bang and is frustrated by. And Peter's in, I think, a worse version of that, because he's just basically got himself and a lot of complicated relationships. Although I did tell you, and I don't know if this will appear in the final draft, but that he has to be a little bit more fond of the Lost Boys and or get along with Ernest better and find...
You gotta stop calling him Ernest. Who knows what his name is? Just...
Don't do me like this.
Just leave him out of it. Nobody cares about Ernest Finn.
Yeah, they do, or you wouldn't have written him in the story.
That's true. People care more about Finn than I ever expected.
Yeah, and I'm like the one person who was like, I don't get it, but that's fine.
Everybody's like, oh, he's a good boy, take care of him. And I'm like, all right.
And then there's me who's like, why is he here? Could he do more? Can he?
To be fair, he should do more.
He will do more. I hate to tell you this, but this is all going to make the final fucking episode. Like, you're not going to get away with not talking about the third character in that book.
Hey, to be fair, Tinkerbell is way more interesting and important.
Tinkerbell's very important. I was going to get to Tink. How dare you? How dare you malign me this way by implying I wasn't going to talk about Tinkerbell? But, I mean, even Tink, Peter doesn't really have a functional relationship with.
I feel like fucking Lucille Bluth. Like, I love all my characters equally. I don't give a shit about Ernest Finn.
That's his full legal name now.
Yeah.
Ernest Finn Bluth.
Ernest Finn.
You know, we've had like two references to a show I don't watch in this podcast. Dead Story, Do Not Read.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm referencing Arrested Development today. I don't watch that show anymore. It's so transphobic. Anyway. Enough of that.
So one of my suggestions to you was to have Peter's relationship with Ernest Finn Bluth be a little bit more reciprocal. In the original version, when Peter shows up, Ernest Finn Bluth...
Please stop talking about him.
No. This is what you have done, and you have to live with it. So, Ernest Finn Bluth, I have to stop talking about him just so I stop laughing, is the de facto leader of the Lost Boys, and Peter comes back, and it's like, why are you on my turf? And they
He's very much a Rufio.
Yeah, he's very Rufio, except he's not Hook. Wearing a crop top. He's also not as, like, twinkly.
Not in this version.
I thought this was, like, the gay version, and you didn't put him in a fucking crop top? Who are you? So, leaving aside my childhood feelings for Rufio, my thing was essentially Peter's relationship with the Lost Boys needed to be deeper, and on top of that, especially with Ernest Finn as the one of the only other sort of B-list characters with any sort of agency, there needed to be more going on there because he was the proxy for the rest of the Lost Boys. And at no point did I feel like in Peter's narrative emotional journey did he consider Finn to be anything other than like an oddity and an irritant, and at one point a potential playmate. And for Finn, I didn't really, because we're stuck in Peter's self-centered head and it was an early draft, I didn't really know what was going on with him either, even though you did fill in that sum. I felt like the entire avenue of the Lost Boys as essentially their own living, breathing whole character, as a sum of their own individual parts, wasn't exploited as much as it should have been. It wasn't utilized. That was one of my notes. My other note was about Tink, who I love. Tink, my princess.
And she's a disgusting insect in this book.
She's a disgusting insect. She's old and gross. And we actually had... We had a long conversation the other night about Tink's role in the story and how one of my notes was I wanted to see more Tink so that through the course of the novel she has more of an impact. And she felt a little underutilized too, because it's a tricky situation to write a Peter Pan story through a very specific lens and not hit notes that have been hit 8,000 times. Like, one of the things that's not in the story that neither of us could find a reason for was Peter's shadow. Although that might change. We might have a mention of that or something. They're here, but they need to be more present.
Yeah, and I wanted to... I think one of the reasons that I kept underutilizing them is I couldn't figure out something to do with them that was different enough and interesting enough to really feel truly distinct from other iterations, but... That's something that I do want to do, and that will hopefully be in the final book. Promises, promises.
We'll see if I'm...
This whole podcast is me promising things I can hopefully deliver on.
Can everyone hear the sound of Austin digging his own grave? Because I can. I'm real excited to give the eulogy.
One thing that I definitely want to talk about is the fact that when I first wrote this book... So the basic premise of Peter's character is that Peter... is the same person as Wendy Darling, and that Wendy Darling is a trans man who developed the persona of Peter Pan as a way of inhabiting, but also exorcising his feelings of being a man in an attempt to sort of put them in a different character who wasn't him, so that he could continue to try to live the life of a cis woman. And that Peter was this kind of childhood character who represented who he really wanted to be, represented a lot about his relationship to his brothers and to other little boys. And then he goes back to being Peter Pan when he's a grown man. I mean, he's not particularly, he's in his 20s, but he's a grown up, and he goes back to this boyish character. The relationship between Peter as a very repressed person who had been living as a cis woman for a long time, and Peter as this sort of like nightmarish little boy fantasy was one of the most complex things that I definitely did not feel like I nailed at all in the first iteration of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Where you've got somebody who has been living as the character we know as Wendy Darling, very deferential and quiet. Wendy isn't always quiet, but like Wendy fully inhabits kind of the role that Wendy is given in the original story, is like happy to go back and be a mom and is happy to grow up and has learned the value of like being a grown up who leaves some of their childhood behind in exchange for something better. And with Peter, I wanted to get at the idea that like, yes, sure, he wants to grow up, but he doesn't want to grow up in the way that he is told he needs to grow up. And so in that sense, he is still kind of the boy who never grew up. And so he's still got this adolescent rage, adolescent childishness in the persona now of like a grown man in Neverland.
Who's allowed to, because it's Neverland, experience every whimsical and or bloodthirsty fantasy he wants to, because it's ostensibly not real. It's an id exercise.
When I wrote the first draft, it was very like, I was mostly focused on who he is in Neverland. And I wrote very little about him outside of Neverland. And I did that in part because I really didn't want to write a tragic book about dysphoria that was really anchored in his sort of painful experiences in the real world. I wanted to write it about who he was in his fantasy world. But, and this is kind of, I think I thought of this because it's kind of also what I did with Kieran, that made it feel like I was gaslighting him and sort of gaslighting trans readers, because I was writing him in response to all these things that I imagined him experiencing in his day-to-day life. You know, all of the things that would make him angry and violent and need to vent when he was in this space. But I was writing him that way without actually writing those things that he was experiencing.
So he just seems untethered, yeah.
Yeah, much like Kieran, who seemed like an asshole until I wrote in the stuff that he was responding to. Peter just is like this demon child.
Without any context. Yeah, that was one of my, I knew, because we'd had discussions about how you wanted to portray the flip side of Peter's existence as like Wendy Darling in the non-Neverland world. And I knew that that was a potential landmine. And so I was like, yeah, that's fine. But I'm glad that I didn't have to make the suggestion that you add context beyond. Because the way that the book opened originally, and I think it has probably changed even now dramatically, yep. Was just like Peter pops up, like he's fished out of the water in Neverland, and he's confused, but it's never clear how confused he is, who he thinks he is. He thinks of himself as Peter. He's like vaguely aware of Hook, and then like there's a whole lot going on, and because Peter is meant to be confused, it's okay that the audience is, but that frequently isn't a great way to start a story. I think one of the only reasons I let it slide initially was because at least this is taking elements from a really famous property. So we know who Peter is. We know who Hook is. We know what Neverland is. We can connect the dots. But without ever really seeing what Peter was like, what Peter is made up of in Neverland is the sum of everything he's sort of repressed, idealized, shoved aside, and it's very, I keep referring to it as like an id fantasy, and it is. It's like he's in god mode and nothing he does matters, and everything's like fun and actually supremely fucked up. So you never actually see what Peter is like when he's not in god mode, really. It's really hard to make a character cohesive without showing all of their sides when they're that disparate, because obviously Peter not in Neverland is a very different creature from the demon boy we see inside Neverland.
Yeah.
But it's one of those situations where as an editor, I did not want to be like, so you need to write like a scene where Peter is living as Wendy Darling and is like dealing with like suitors and shit. Like, I don't want any of that necessarily. It's just one of the things we originally agreed on when we were talking about reworking the beginning was, can you make it more obvious that he's turning into this Peter? Can we have more of a mental shift? Can we change the tone? Can we put in markers that establish that Peter doesn't just spring up in Neverland fully formed as someone who might just kill you because he's bored?
The big things that I wanted to address with his character was that I wanted it to be clear that this is somebody who has been in Neverland before and has engaged in this sort of like little boy world before, but has been living in the intermediate years for the vast majority of his life as a cis woman in the early 1900s, and has experienced, you know, great oppression through that, and has experienced the threat of male violence, and has sort of had to deal with all of the scary things that women have to deal with, and that is the context in which a lot of his actions take place, is not being able to respond to that, and then suddenly being in a place where he has the power to just wreck anyone who so much as bothers him,
mm-hmm.
or bores him, or takes up his time. I really shied away from that storytelling the first time I wrote the book. I really shied away from a lot of details about Peter because at the time I really wanted to write more of an escapist fantasy, which is funny because I wrote a really sad book.
Yeah, that book is not it's not escapism, not. And it's barely fantasy.
Yeah, it's very sad. It's really, like, I remember when Daria was reading it and she was like, I'm about to just start crying from stress because this book is so fucked up and sad. So I clearly did not succeed in writing an escapist fantasy.
No.
Because I wrote Peter as that character, even though I wasn't addressing that was why he
what
was that character.
Him, yeah.
So he is twisted and screwed up, but I just never was like, that's why. And so with Peter, I started to write that into him a lot more, and that was what finally kind of made his character click for me, was writing in very explicitly, like, he is afraid, and he is reacting to the actual way he has been treated, and to the specter of male violence.
Which is funny, because he is male violence in
yes.
this story.
Yeah, and it's the reason, the place where it gets into interesting territory with transmasculinity for me is that then he goes on and enacts a whole lot of violence. He jumps in and enacts a whole bunch of male violence. A lot of the story is dealing with his toxic masculinity, because hit to him, like, he's gonna go off and be a boy, and that means he's gonna stab a lot of things with knives and, like, fight anyone he wants and punch anybody who says anything to him. And he's a very violent character. Writing him in a way that was much more responsive to the life that I thought he had led made that feel a lot more authentic. And not just like, who is this asshole, like, flying around punching
just
people?
Just a flying sociopath.
Peter's internalized homophobia is also something that relates very directly to his transmasculinity in that he is coming from a period of time where the distinction between a trans person and a gay person was just starting to be made. Like,
yeah.
it was in that period of time when Magnus Hirschfeld and other researchers started to be like, hey, you know, like, some people are gay and transish, and some people are not at all that, and maybe these are two separate categories. And obviously, I mean, that's a distinction people still sometimes have trouble with today, but it was just starting to happen, and so Peter feels very invalidated in his own gender by the fact that he's gay. I write him as a gay man, and he's never been attracted to women, which would have been a way for him to kind of enact his masculinity, sort of, like, not actually, but, like, in the way that he's conceived of gender and the way that people around him conceive of gender. To be a real man is to be a man in relation to a woman. And for him, as a trans dude, to be very gay is just another level of, like, oh god, what the fuck do I do with this? And so he is very, like, scared of gay men and confused by them and upset by his reactions to them. That's another thing that I hope is clear to my readers now. In 2017.
People who read the book, we hope, we pray.
I was very, very firm that this was not going to be a story where there had been any inkling of sexual attraction between Hook and Peter.
When Peter was younger.
At all.
At all.
100% zero. It was not a cheerful writing experience. Mm-hmm. I think, honestly, that's part of why I softened how much I wanted to deal with Peter's dysphoria, because the very first, this is like the pre-first draft, this was the draft zero, when I was still really dicking around with what it was going to be, I wrote a whole bunch of Peter's life outside of Neverland and him realizing that he was trans, and it was just awful. Like, it felt awful to write, and that I suspect was just, like, me as a trans person not being able to deal with someone in that toxic a mind frame. Like, it sucks. Like, and I remember that, and it's awful. This, by the way, is a great reason why cis people shouldn't write those narratives. Just shout out. Shout out to that concept. Don't write, like, that.
You probably don't understand this at a level to be able to evoke it, and also, like, maybe this isn't... Generally, it's like a romance space. Why do you want to make everyone?
Yeah, I mean, especially romance. Honestly, any space though.
But especially romance.
I am at this point 3 years out from that particular time in my life, and trying to re-enter it to write, you know, the beginning of a book was just awful. It was awful. And so I was like, I can't do this to me. I don't really want to do this to Peter. This feels like misery porn. Even when it wasn't, like, miserable, it's just the wrongness of it was really nasty. And so I pulled back from that hard when I clicked on the idea of it being set almost entirely in Neverland. I was like, okay, I'm just not going to do that. That felt really bad. I'm not going to do that at all.
Oh, no wonder. That makes sense. I mean, I think it's a logistical choice that's good, or at least appeared to be good at the time anyway. But I can see it being as more of a influenced by the fact that you were utterly miserable trying to craft the prelude to that.
I went back and read, because I still have it all. I read the first couple chapters that I'd written in that, and I was like, Jesus, why did you think this was a good idea?
Only you, too. I'm like, hey, could you write a romance novel that's enemies to lovers? And you're like, what if I write the agony of the trans realization of Peter Pan? I was like, yeah, why don't you do that? And then submit it to me while I stare at you. Like, what the... love how that's still kind of, I mean, the realization isn't there, but definitely all of the agony still is.
Yeah.
Oh, I love this little book. I will protect it. It's so good.
With your editorial scissors.
Stab it.
Snip away all the bullshit I wrote. Leave a beautiful butterfly.
I'll stab it with my steely knives, but I just can't kill the beast.
What is the beast in this metaphor?
Peter's toxic... mindset? His emotions?
I guess. Peter's bad feelings.
Peter's negativity.
Also, it has a happy ending, I promise.
It does. I wouldn't have published it if it didn't. LT3 would have been like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. I feel the need to be like, okay, so like I am talking about all of this painful stuff, but part of the reason that I can write this stuff is because it's a romance novel, and I am forced to imagine it with a happy ending.
Forced to? Really? That's the tone you're gonna take?
No, like, it's not a bad thing, because I wouldn't write it otherwise. No matter where my brain goes, I have to write a way out of it.
No matter how dark it gets, you gotta turn it back around.
If I go down like a brain spiral of like dysphoria hell, I kind of need someone. I need external pressure to be like, no, it doesn't end badly for them. They're gonna be happy, asshole. Good things can happen.
Like, I love... I was just thinking about how when you went full tilt for like the happy ending, mm-hmm. like you went full tilt, you went like, I'm going to have this, I'm going to have, you know, a love confession, I'm going to have that. I was just like, this seems, I don't know, jarring. I don't even remember what I said, but I was like, this needs to be tempered because it's just too much of a tonal shift.
Yeah, I still want it to be very happy.
No, I want it to be very happy.
And it will
happy,
be. It's going to be.
Some of that's going to be from evening out the tone of the rest of the book. Still really good. I just feel like I got hit in the face with, like, a sparkling, glittery bouquet of happy. And
Fairy dust.
I literally got fairy dust thrown in my face, and I'm apparently allergic to it.
Think of a wonderful thing. Don't sue me, Disney.
I'm sneezing. No, it's parody. It's transformative.
It was parody.
It was parody, because...
That's maybe one other thing to say about it. Like, I did not draw any inspiration from the Disney version, even though I kept getting the pirate song stuck in my head while I was writing it. I was really heavily influenced by reading the original book right before I wrote it.
Yeah, and stylistically,
which is
that shows
fucked up.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew, because everybody is always like, oh yeah, Peter Pan, the original's fucked up. I was not prepared. Like, what the hell? What the goddamn hell is that book? Like,
it's a lot.
It's really screwed up.
I read it for the first time when I was 15, and I was like, this is just too edgy for me. Like, me obsessed with, like, fucking true crime. I just can't read this book.
There's a lot. There's a lot in the in Peter Darling that is a reference to the book that is not necessarily in other adaptations and the stage play. For example, the fact that, like, Peter... is generally played by a cis woman in stage adaptations.
Which is still kind of weird, but all right.
I would prefer that Peter were played only by trans boys, but like...
I would be.
I have a vested interest.
Arrange the world according to your whims. I know what your Neverland would be, then.
Ugh. I mean, I hope it would not be like Peter's, to be honest.
No, I don't think it would be like Peter's much at all.
It would be full of gay pirates. Anyway, no, what was I saying? I was saying something important. What was I saying?
No. It's more important for me to make dumb jokes about how the only thing in your Neverland would be Captain Hook's outfits and a pair of thigh-high leather boots.
Okay, look.
I'm gonna fight you about that until the end of time.
He's gonna wear them.
He's not gonna wear them. They're gonna
We're
be
gonna
in
find
closet.
Out in 6 months which one of us won and whether or not Hook wears thigh-high boots.
Look, he can own them. They can be in his closet that he examines. He cannot wear them. I refuse.
Mrs. Jean, do you...
Mrs.
Miss Jean.
Who am I married to except the Lord?
Miss Jean, do you really want to go down the rabbit hole of Hook's closet? Do you want me to describe everything in Hook's closet?
No.
I don't think you do. I think you want him to be wearing a pair of thigh-high boots in one scene.
Oh God, I don't want this to be the hill that I die on, Austin. Last time our argument was about a comma before the word and this time I'm like, you do not put those fucking leather boots in this goddamn story.
Okay, look, he's already wearing leather boots in absolutely every single scene. They're just not thigh high in every single scene.
I'm just picturing him putting them on, or I should say making the pirates put them on him.
I think he dresses himself.
I mean, I imagine he has some outfits that are so ornate that he needs the help.
That's probably true. But I feel like he doesn't trust other people's filthy hands to touch
on
him.
On his beautiful...
Most of the time. Anyway, I was saying, everything is a reference to the original. A lot of Hook's sort of persona came from stuff that's present in the original that is not... It carries through in some of the adaptations in certain ways, but a lot of times they make him fairly cartoonish. And he still is cartoonish in the book, but he's a little more... He's more of a dandy, like, and you can see that, and he's more, like, a weird, like, highly educated dude.
You know what we should bring up is the fact that we keep, in utter seriousness, reflecting on how much if Peter and Hook were contemporary and real, they would just be LARPing all of the time?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Fully.
Definitely in
And, like,
my
the people
mind,
who take it too seriously.
I don't know if I want to say this, because I don't feel like people will still want to read the book. If I admit that in my head, in the modern AU, Peter and Hook play D&D every day, and LARP 100% of the time, and they're insufferable, and other LARPers want them to go away because they're way more into it than anybody else. Anyway, I was going to say, things that I'm taking from the book.
LARPing.
I don't know. I don't remember. I don't remember anymore, Amanda.
Not the shadow.
No, because that one is just one of the things that, I don't know, like, it's fine.
It's a fine metaphor, but, like...
What is it a metaphor for? I don't even know what that means.
What are shadows metaphors for? A shadow self acting with its own sentience and
I
its
guess,
own...
but when does that ever come up again in the book?
It doesn't. That's what I'm saying. It's a half-baked metaphor, but it's, like, at least a solid metaphor in its own, like, inherence, I guess.
I guess. It just doesn't go anywhere. Anyway, this is me critiquing
J.M. Barrie. You could
have
done something with it.
Oops. I don't care about it. Anyway.
Me. You should have done something with the shadow. You. No.
I don't care about the shadow. I took a lot from Peter's, like, the weirdnesses of Peter's character. One of my favorite things about the original book is how many quotations from it people are like, oh, that's so beautiful or so deep. And it's literally Peter bullshitting. Mm-hmm. Like, it's him making shit up on the spot.
Little sociopath. One of
my favorite, like, the second star on the right thing canonically means nothing. Like, that's a bullshit thing that Peter says because he's insecure about the fact that he doesn't have an address to get sent letters to. And Wendy is like, where do your letters go? And Peter's like, second star on the right, straight until morning. And she's like, oh.
Ooh, you fancy, huh?
Or actually, no, that's inaccurate. Like... She's like, where do you live? And he's like, second star to the right, straight until morning. And she's like, do letters go there? And he's like, I don't get any. And then she's like, oh, you poor baby. Then he's insecure about it. And, like, he's insecure about the fact that his name is shorter than hers. And he forgets who Wendy and the Lost Boys are over and over again. Because he's a giant baby. with no sense of, what is it?
Permanence? Object permanence?
Yeah. And... this one I actually call out in the book. Like, at one point he tells Hook that he is youth and joy and a little bird broken out of its egg. And I'm pretty sure it's called out right after that in the text that, like, that's bullshit. That doesn't mean anything. He literally just says words because they sound good. Which is one of the other aspects of Peter's character that I took a lot of, is that he's somebody who bullshits a lot and fronts a lot.
Yeah, and I like that he spins his own... Like, he spins the narrative of Wendy while in Neverland, or had... He had done that when he was a kid, right?
Yeah, like, he kind of tells a story about who Wendy is, who is somebody separate from him. It's another way of him sort of, oh yeah, but that's not me, though.
I liked that. I thought that that was a good way. I mean, especially because Peter Pan is such a storyteller thing anyway, and so many of the iterations involve, you know... Who told it? Who overheard it? Who wrote it down? Is it J.M. Barrie? Is it someone else? Is it, you know, it's... So adding that extra layer of meta where Peter's, like, writing his own story and retelling his own story and lying about everything is so good. God, he's such a little demon and I love him.
Well, and that came from the fact that I actually love Wendy as a character as well. And so I didn't just want to write it like Wendy didn't exist, because Peter and Wendy are the same person in this. It's not that Wendy doesn't exist. Wendy is sort of more the true persona. It's just that Wendy is a guy in this. Wendy is trans. And so Wendy canonically is the storyteller. Wendy in the original version is the one who tells the story of Peter Pan and all of the other narratives and just makes up stories constantly. Wendy tells lots of stories to John and Michael to entertain them and is sort of spinning the stories as much as Peter is. So I wanted that to be an aspect of Peter's character.
I will interrupt you to tell you that one thing I probably didn't think of at the time, but would like to see references to in the updated version, is references to Peter's brothers, more of them. Because that was one of the things you were talking about, like, actually going in and filling in the details about Peter's family.
Yeah, when I say that Peter in the original version doesn't reference his life outside of Neverland, I mean...
You meant that.
Never. I mean, absolutely, almost never.
He's so contextless in so many ways.
And I didn't want it to be a trans reveal book, but I wound up writing it that way because I avoided talking about his life so much.
That was what was so strange to me, because I was like, this presented to me like it's a surprise, but I mean,
not.
The blurb's gonna say the title is a dead giveaway. I guess if you were paying attention to clues along the way.
I'm very excited to find out what shape the book is in next year. And I'm already excited for future Austin, who has already done editing and doesn't have to do this anymore.
Yeah, Austin's working on another project. Good luck, future Austin.
Yeah.
Good luck, future Amanda. God knows what you're fucking working on. God. Get your to-do list under control, future Amanda. I think by that I will have, by far. But I'm really excited for, hopefully the people who are listening to this have read Peter Darling. And I think
going to read.
Yeah, we're going to read.
Or just enjoy listening to me talk about it, because Lord knows I can do that all fucking day.
Maybe this is their, like, I'm deciding whether or not to read it. in which case, sorry, we scared you off by shaking a broom of misery at you.
It'll be happier in the final draft.
It will be. I'll make it. I'll fucking stand behind you with a pitchfork. That's the benefit of living with someone, because you get to bully them into doing what you want with edits. So it's cool to have this opportunity to talk to you. We've had a lot of really minutia-filled, detail-focused conversations about content in Peter Darling, but we wanted to talk about some of the broader stuff, and also we thought it would be a cool contrast to show you what it looks like in its still cooking version versus its more final version. And also, because Austin and I are good friends and roommates that have worked together before, I don't have to, like, if I had some poor person who I have edited for, like, maybe once and who doesn't know me in person on the podcast, we would have to do a lot of very careful.
You wouldn't be able to say, like, hey, this part sucked.
I wouldn't be able to make fun of you quite as much as I've made fun of you for your obsession with Hook's thigh-high boots. I probably would fight you less hard on
oh,
that.
Oh, he is a pirate king.
Go away! I can hear you singing that through the house.
Yeah, I do wander around my apartment singing Pirates of Penzance
yep.
now. And before, but more now.
More now. Way more now.
Which is a good place to stop.
Yeah. So take it away, 2017, Amanda and Austin. Hope y'all are better versions of us.
Get those New Year's revolutions in. Revolutions. Get the revolutions. New Year's revolutions in. All right. Well, so this is a sort of special session of the Peter Darling Edit Talk, because Amanda and I are now, I would say, probably more than halfway through the process of editing the book. And
also, we better be more than halfway through. I'll die.
I think we are. And we decided we would just do a little check-in. The date is December 19th. And if you were wondering how down to the wire books can be, the book comes out on February 15th. Right now, the book is once again with me. I am in the middle of a line edit that is quite substantial and wrestling with all sorts of demons.
I wouldn't even call that a line edit.
It's a line content edit. It's a content edit that I'm doing like a line edit.
That makes so much sense, Austin.
I can explain. So it is technically a content edit, but what I've learned about my process is that I work best if I treat it like a line edit, aka going through kind of sentence by sentence, because that's how I hash out character arcs best. I have a really hard time jumping in to a scene that's halfway through the book and being like, all right, here's everybody. That's something that I would love to get better at, but right now it just completely throws off my groove, and I wind up rewriting the chapter anyway later. So I'm just a very linear writer. So I tend to start at the beginning and work forward with every edit and just try to bring everything in line, which is why it feels like a line edit.
I feel like you're spending a lot of words not talking about the fact that literally everything we talked about in our previous recording session,
I was
Peter Darling is wrong and a lie.
I was defending myself.
I don't want to hear your defenses.
Yeah, everything I said before is a lie. I don't even know how much to go into it, because we were only going to talk for 10 minutes, and I could probably talk for 2 hours about how everything I said before was a lie.
So we can state categorically that we have since added a Hook POV. We have changed the beginning another 4 times, changed the ending at least twice.
Yeah.
I mean, it has the same general ending, just the
it has
way
the
it
same
unfolds.
Ending. It has different climactic moments. Like, the build to the ending keeps changing. I'm crossing my fingers right now. I feel pretty good about everything right now.
I'm glad one of us does. No, I actually, we were talking last night about the status of the MD projects, the My Dearest Enemy projects, and I'm really excited. And I feel good about Peter Darling, despite the fact that I wish we had an extra month to play with because we're still hashing out content. But it's looking, I mean, every pass of this book gets it closer to where it needs to be. And every pass gets it in some ways tighter, in some ways looser, in some ways bigger, because you and every other author are trying to send me to an early grave.
My favorite part of this is that last night we were talking about Amanda's edits for another book that is also supposed to be 50K. And Amanda was like, well, it's apparently 60K. And I was like, wow, Peter Darling is only 52K. And Amanda's like, I can't believe you are the one who's less verbose right now. And then I guiltily looked at my list of additions to make and was like, you know, maybe don't say that yet.
Maybe we're ahead of
maybe
ourselves.
Maybe don't give me that credit yet.
Never let it fall to me to give you credit you don't deserve.
No. It is right now 51,000 words. 51 and 70. What? That's... I completely lost. Yeah, 51,700. I completely lost the ability to say numbers for a second there.
That's fine.
Anyway.
That's not what I need from you.
Anyway, my point is, it's under 52K right now.
Great. How many more scenes and chapters do you have to write, Austin? How many more?
I have two more chapters to write. However, I also have chapters to cut.
I think that was the literal embodiment of pained editor noises. Mm-hmm. Just, no. You've been lucky because I've been sick the past week, and you were lucky because you were recovering from surgery, and therefore I could not hover over your shoulder and go, how's Peter Darling? Then again, I had it because you were recovering from surgery.
Yeah, I swear to God, this manuscript has just had so many things, both personally and like internationally, in the way of it happening. Everything from the 2016 election to me getting top surgery in the middle of edits has reared its head. So when this book is done, I am personally going to feel a sense of incredible triumph, I think.
I'm going to feel a sense of triumph, but I think I'm going to be panicked until I sign off on the galley.
Yeah.
Because then it's mostly out of my hands. I mean, once I send it to copy, it'll be out of my hands too, but we'll at least get it back to look at it and poke at it. And the thing is like, you know, Austin, you're pretty stressed working with Peter Darling and knowing that, oh, there are deadlines that I have to hit. Guess what? I have to do this with five manuscripts, although one of them's already done, to my credit and to the author's credit. One has been done, and then the others are all just sort of ambling toward completion somehow, and it'll happen by the sweat and blood and tears of my own body. These books will be done.
Every bodily fluid you've contributed to this particular collection.
I feel like these novels' godparent. Like I helped them.
I can't wait to see them all in a beautiful stack.
I know, I'm so excited. One of them's not long enough to hit print, which makes me a little sad, but everything else is. Everything else is going to be a beautiful stack of beauty that I'm going to put on my desk and never look away from. MDE has been a beautiful labor of love, and I'll be glad to shove it out the door, so it's not my responsibility anymore. I feel so bad for my boss, who occasionally checks in, like, all right, what are you working on this month? And I'm like, it's still this story! And this one, and that one. More MDE for you, and for me, and for everybody. One of the ones I just sent back, I was like, don't even count this as a full pass. It needed to go back.
We are doing such editorial shenanigans to have this collection together, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to say we were doing the Lord's work, and I was like, well.
I mean, I don't know.
Would there be quite this much porn? Yeah, right?
But I am, I will say, to jump into sort of what I actually am doing on the book as opposed to what I have not done on the book, I am very happy with the additions I'm making at this point, and very happy that yesterday I wrote such a gay scene that I just like walked out of my room being like, I've never written anything so gay. And that was a good feeling.
My favorite part of this is you seem to forget that the people who are listening to this or will be listening to this in some future date are people who will have read the book.
Yeah.
So you can talk freely. You can say what scene it is that you wrote.
I guess.
What scene was it?
Well, you haven't
what was
read
that?
It.
What was that chuckle?
I don't know.
What was that? You're sending me to an early grave.
You haven't read it is the thing.
So?
I guess you will probably at some point read it.
Me, your editor, won't ever read this scene that you just wrote. It's not like you're due to get the manuscript back to me by the end of the month or whatever.
No, it's the scene where Peter goes up the mountain and Hook ambushes him. They just enjoy each other a lot while fighting. Peter's...
I was going to say, orally?
Peter is so extremely gay for Hook and has no idea.
Oh, I was going to say, that's a huge change that we've made since the last draft, is you've stripped away a lot of Peter's internalized and externalized homophobia.
Yeah, I basically was just like, I don't actually want this in the book.
Yeah, there's enough going on.
I think one of the things that started to occur to me is that I write a lot of contemporary trans characters who, I think in many ways, a contemporary trans masculine character has more opportunity to kind of deal with and process more cis normative masculinity. But the way I have Peter's arc set up, he really doesn't have a chance outside of Neverland to experience boyhood and experience how the world reacts to boyhood. So he still has all these complicated ideas about what it means to be a man, but he doesn't have that kind of like gut homophobia, which would have kind of been beaten into him in other ways, I think. He doesn't have that violent homophobia. So that was something I just stripped out because I think it was a complication that it didn't need, and it was a twist on sort of his personal development that was just sort of obscuring stuff that I wanted to talk about. So I wound up stripping that out.
I wonder how many things we have just gotten rid of wholesale. Well, I made you get rid of the talking sharks.
You did.
That was a good call.
I have cut them out. They're still in the draft in strike through right now. And every so often I scroll past them and laugh.
I was like, do we really have to have the fucking talking sharks for a paragraph?
They make me giggle.
I'm glad they make you giggle. They made me go, oh no, there's talking sharks.
Why do you have such a bias?
For a paragraph, too. It wasn't even like you introduced this colony of talking Is it whales or sharks?
They're definitely sharks.
Okay. I had a moment of panic, and I was like, did I miscategorize these beautiful sea creatures? But yeah, I remember getting to that in the past and being like, these are going right. Well, first I was like, wow, they're talking. I don't know how I feel about them talking. And that was the previous pass. And then the most recent one was, can we just get rid of the fucking talking sharks? I don't like them anymore this time around.
My favorite editorial feedback of all time. Can we please just get rid of the fucking talking sharks?
Oh, God.
And I did.
And you did. Yeah, we've gotten rid of, I mean, so many of the stages of Peter Darling have been so different. You know, first there was no prologue, then there was a prologue, then it was in London, then it was like maybe not in London. We added the Hook POV, the build-up to the ending changed, sex scenes changed, the cave sequence will kill me and bury me and pallbear my corpse.
I think it's going to kill me first because I have to straighten it out in this draft.
That'll be ironic, because you were the one who gave me this head cold, so...
Was I, though?
It was Keezy, and then Keezy gave it to you, and then you gave it to me.
Sorry.
It was the circle of life.
I'm still not convinced me and Keezy had the same thing, because...
Maybe not.
I was immunocompromised at the time, and I was sick for 3 days, and she was fine, and had...
And she's still sick.
...the zombie plague.
She's still not doing great. Anyway... yeah, Peter Darling has changed so much, and I'm so excited to see it grow. I'm excited to fully line edit it, because I didn't really get a chance. I haven't had a chance to do any of my nitpicky line edits, really.
It's been such a complex thing to nail from a content standpoint. Like, I haven't had this much trouble nailing down the actual events in a book in a long time.
If ever. It's pretty massive.
Yeah, it's just been, there's been so many things where I've gone back and forth trying to, I think it's the challenge of having a book that in my head has kind of an aesthetic soul, to put it in a really pretentious way, but it has like a thing that I'm trying to convey that is not very concrete in terms of like what needs to happen for that. It's very, very internal to the characters and not, I mean, it's action-y, but the actions are mostly about what they represent to the characters. What that means is that I keep jumping around on like, okay, so I've got this idea and a soul of the book. What do I have to do to actually make that come out? And maybe this whole sequence needs to be about something else, and maybe this action shouldn't happen, and maybe they need to go over here. And I don't think
stop
there's
being
a
so
single,
vague.
There's a single, well, it, I mean, that's how it feels though. It's like, so, okay, in this version, they go on the boat. And then later I'm like, no, but you know, it would be way better for the idea is if they went by land. I don't know.
It just, vision.
Yeah.
And there's me who's like, fuck your vision.
Fucking write the book, asshole.
This needs to be more dynamic. Make it do this to get rid of the sharks. I'm glad you gave Tinkerbell a role, too. That was a big thing.
Love that
me.
Tinkerbell.
Tinkerbell, the crankiest old lady fairy.
And now I ship her in the Fairy Queen, and I hope other people do, too.
That'll be good. I hope people do, too.
It's just one of those things where it's like, there's really no place for it in this book. But I put in, like, the queen referring to her by her first name for no reason other than I ship it.
Self-indulgence, but yeah. You gotta get your kicks where you can, man.
And Tink is like a single mom with the worst son.
The trying to date. Son. Yeah, ignore my child destroying half of everything.
He's fucking up again, but look, he's a good kid in there somewhere.
You want some wine? I drank
wine. Now he's dating a man 15 years older than him.
Who
LARPs as a pirate every day.
Oh yeah, we've determined how much of Peter Darling is just about the fact that they're hardcore
LARPing.
LARPers.
LARPing every day.
LARPing every minute of this fucking book, which was a horrifying realization when you told that to me.
I don't think I've ever had two main characters who I think of as so insufferable, yet I like them so much, but I'm
no,
also
I
like
too,
get away from me. Ease up. I'm like, dial it back, like, 20 notches. Nobody cares about your vision for this character. It's much like you and me.
Someone starts screaming, is that a real pistol?
Yeah. Yeah.
James is like, yes, it is. It's loaded, too.
Horrible method actors.
Well, I think on that note, we should finish this up so that we have more to talk about when you're finally done with this hell manuscript. And we can talk about it in its final version.
You say that in my heart, I'm still just like, will the manuscript be done? Or is this the manuscript that you
don't
will,
even say that.
You will, like, scatter the pages on my grave, still covered in red ink. Here lies Austin. Why wouldn't he finish this goddamn book?
You send me the manuscript and it's mysteriously corrupt when I try and open the doc.
Yeah.
I go, huh, that's interesting. Austin, can I see it on your screen? And you're like, I don't know, it's not working now.
Oh no, I lost it all in the garbage.
I threw it out. Cleaned my recycling bin cache, I don't know.
Whoops. Anyway, yeah, see you on the other side of this manuscript, which is going to be a glorious time. I'm going to be sipping a margarita and just lounging.
I really hope that the tone of voice... future me has when we resume this recording is somewhat less beaten down. So take it away, future Amanda.
Enjoy. Hello, Amanda. Welcome back to part 3 of Peter Darling.
Hello, Austin. How are you feeling, I should ask, because...
Well, first, let's set the scene.
Oh, we're setting the scene.
It is... January. It's not January. It's February. I was looking at the number 2 while I said it was January. It's February 4th, 2017. I am done with Peter Darling in an amazing world I never knew I'd be in, where Peter Darling is done.
A whole new world.
You can tell already I'm real coherent today. Peter Darling is currently in galley / advanced reader copy form. People are reading it without me, completely unsupervised.
They're not beaming their thoughts directly into your brain.
Yeah, people I don't know even. If you can't tell, I'm a bit of a neurotic mess over this. It's coming out in 10 days-ish.
Yeah.
At least through Less Than Three Press. The last thing, I still have a few things to do on it, little tweaks to the galley that I need to make and send back before it goes to print. But other than that, the book is fully done. Yeah, here we are. We made it.
We did. It'll be especially funny to hear this at the tail end of all of the slogging and, like, beaten down, terrified. Because I feel like at least in the last recording, I remember us being sort of just,
Yeah.
And now we're happy people.
The last edit was rough. I think we couldn't actually remember when it was, but we're fairly certain, without having gone back to check, that it was the pass that I did over the holidays, which was long and wretched.
It was December 19th, it looks like.
Oh, okay, so it was just starting the wretched slog. Okay, well, if we'd recorded that like 2 weeks later, I would have been...
crying.
I would have just unhinged my jaw and screamed. Yeah, so the timeline of what has happened since then is that was me resuming edits after having recovered from surgery, needing to get the book to kind of like a really mostly finalized state. And I finished that pass on January 1st and did two more editing passes between then and...
It's galley form.
It's galley form, which I finished on the 30th of January.
That wasn't like a tight turnaround or anything. That
No.
was plenty of time.
No, this is not at all like a tight framework to finish a book in.
It's a super...
On top of work and school.
Yeah. It was a super accelerated turnaround on everything. And we should mention, now is a good time to mention that we gained an editor in the
Yes.
process of editing.
An invaluable editor.
An invaluable asset.
Yeah. James Loke, who is a... dear friend of both of ours and a fantastic author in their own right, was one of the first readers on Peter Darling, was one of the first people who I knew would be excited about this book, has pretty much been encouraging me to write it since like last July when I started working on it, and read the really, really rough draft long before anybody else, and then came on in January to be a second set of eyes and wrestle with the book, and... they were fantastic. I was so glad that they came on because, I don't know, this is just, it's a very me book, but it's also a very James book in a lot of ways. And so them coming back was an amazing chance for somebody who was really keyed into that to be like, okay, this is all the stuff you've dropped that you shouldn't have. This is all the stuff you need to add. And this is what's wrong with the entire middle of your book.
The slog of the middle. But yeah, James was unbelievably helpful. James is a fantastic editor. They saved us both because for you, you had been slogging through the story for so long that...
I couldn't see the forest for the trees. I couldn't even see the forest. I was just sort of lying face down in
a pile
the twigs.
Of leaves. Yeah.
Yeah. Just like, take me back to the earth. Reclaim me. This is my grave.
And James came along at a time when we both desperately needed them to. And I should note, James was another editor, another content and line editor on Dangerous Times, which is another MDE, another My Dearest Enemy story. So they swooped in as a pinch hitter in a lot of ways. And carried some projects to completion, which is a hard thing for any editor to do, but I am so incredibly grateful. And they work for LT3. It's not like we just found... we just...
just like, hey, James.
Posted a Craigslist ad and was like, here you go. Like, their input on Peter Darling was so incredible. And I remember I got the last... because we were basically going to split a pass and it ended up pretty... I mean, it was kind of 50-50, but it was also... I started noting little line things. Oh, this is a great time to dovetail into the what the last edit pass was like for you. Or I should say edit passes. Good Lord.
I was talking to a dear friend about process of writing this book, because Z has seen me go through many, many stages. And Z was like, how many passes did you do on this book? And I was just kind of like, well, that depends on what you mean by a pass on the book, because there were five drafts, and I reread and rewrote the book a highly variable number of times, depending on the draft, up to like four or five. And so it was just, it was a lot of the book. And the last pass, or the last draft, I did on a very, again, a very accelerated timeline. The last pass, so I keep saying pass, the last draft I did in, I think, 3 days, and read the book four times. Just kept, like, looping through. And that was, like, a couple passes just to incorporate changes from editors, and then a full line edit, and then a full copy edit. An infinity of screams. But it was totally worth it.
I felt really badly when I was looking back over it and starting to notice word repetition and echoes. Mm-hmm. And then I ran it through. There's a counter where it'll tell you your most frequently used words and phrases, and you can set it like three words and a phrase or whatever. And so I did that, and never do that. Just accept.
I mean, always do that.
Always do that. Oh.
Always do that, and then accept and acknowledge your own suffering. But always do that. Actually, I was going to highlight that as like a self-editing tip that I think people can and should do. That would be, it's something I'm planning on doing in the future before I throw a book at Amanda. It was just extremely useful at that stage to see not only what words I echoed, but what phrases. Because I realized that I get into a lot of patterns of phrasing that I'm not consciously aware of. In this book, it turned out it was of the. Everything was the thing of the thing.
I mean, that's a very easy phrase to use in any context, but you notice that it wasn't evenly sprinkled throughout the book.
Yeah, it was super weird. It was like specific times and specific types of description I would do would just become the thing of the thing of the thing of the thing of the thing. And then there would be like none for pages. And then there would be another section where everything was the thing of the thing again. And it was easy to fix, but I was going through and it was just interesting to realize how totally invisible it was to me. Even when it was kind of ludicrous, every single time I was describing the bottom of the cave that they were in, I said the bottom of the cave or the floor of the cave. It was the floor of the cave that really got me. Who doesn't say the cave floor ever? But every single time it was the floor of the cave. You know, there's a way to say that that contains two less words. That's another thing. Sorry, we're going to be all over the place. I'm just going to accept it. Another of the interesting things was how much the word count changed in the last two or three drafts. It was under the word count. Initially, when I first turned it in, it was with some wiggle room, a couple thousand words short of where we thought it would be. And we were like, it's definitely going to have more. So we'll just call it 40K for now. We started with 40, actually. It was 37 when I turned it in.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yes,
God.
Amanda.
Who were we then?
I don't know. So it was 37, and then it ballooned by, it peaked at over 60,000 words. And then I cut it back to 47, and then I was nervous because I'd said it was 50,000, and I was like, oh, now I'm a liar. I added 7,000 words. It actually wound up being almost exactly 50,000 words when I finished it. So the amount of new content for this book, I don't even want to know. The amount that I wrote in edits was... I mean, I literally added at least 50,000, or not 50, I literally added at least 20,000 words, then cut at least like 15,000 words. Lord.
It was a trial, and I watched you just sink into your edits and not be able to come out and put everything off in your life, pretty much everything.
The last 72 hours of edits, I edited for over 40 of those hours.
You basically took breaks to put food in your body and sleep. Ugh.
It was a time. It was what had to be done.
It was. Unfortunately, we did not have the luxury of a couple more weeks of more passes. It was just, this has to get done by the deadline. And you had the tools you needed. You just didn't have the time.
And I did feel good at the end of where it was at.
Oh, yeah.
This is not to say that I didn't feel happy with what I finally put out there, but I only felt happy with what I had because I spent 14 hours working on it on the last day.
I'm extremely happy with how it turned out and so relieved that it's going. I mean, at the time of this release, it will have been out. So that's fine. But
I'll be screaming in whole new ways that we don't even know yet.
We have yet to. I was talking to Austin about this yesterday and the day before and probably every day of his life. But he's so funny in so many ways. He is not like a stereotype of a precious author, if that makes any sense. Like, he's very willing to chuck things out the window and listen to other people. And like, he's collaborative and he's very chill. He's a very low key person, except when he's not. And this is an except when he's not. He is a parody of himself.
I'm losing it.
We were out to dinner. We were out having dim sum, and I noticed Megan Durr, the CEO of Less Than Three Press, was like, a whole lot of people are requesting Peter Darling on NetGalley, you know, da 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 da. And I showed it to Austin, who had made a promise that he was only going to check Twitter once during.
And I did. I kept my promise.
I destroyed your promise. I did it because I knew you would want to see it. And you were so happy that you just sort of, I don't know. I don't know how to describe the body language. You
made shrill sounds.
Sort of hunched up and put your hands to your face. It was real cute. He's just a happy boy. He's so happy.
I'm just really excited.
And nervous. Yeah.
I'm really, really, really excited about the book. It's manifesting in me just sort of like endlessly smashing my face against Twitter and being like, is anybody talking about my book? Is anybody like, no, I don't want to intrude, and I won't intrude. I'm just very, very, very excited that my book exists in the world and that other people can now read it.
Other
finally.
People are probably reading it right this actual minute.
They might even be. At this moment in history,
he just sort of wanders around the apartment like, I'm like, are you okay?
I'm very excited.
Our household has been, I just realized our household has been an emotional mess for the last like 2 days.
Just a household of creative freelancers all
experiencing emotion,
spiraling. Yeah. Austin's losing his goddamn mind, and
that's what a book release feels like.
And yes, this is what a book release feels like. Everything is very thrilling and very stressful.
I'm so proud of it. It's like I'm its godparent. Although I am the first person to say, like, your book is not your child. Your book is not your baby.
I have a lot of empathy for that statement sometimes. My feeling is that, like, your book is absolutely not your baby, in that it is your job to, like, I don't know, defend it from the world. In that sense, your book is not your child. In the sense that it does feel like your baby, in that you created it from within yourself and labored to bring it into the world. In that way, it very much does feel like my baby. It also feels like my Horcrux, in that I feel like I put off so many like life requirements that it just, that I was also peeling out a little part of my soul and like sticking it in there to sustain it.
Just as like a bookmark.
Yeah, a soul bookmark. And now I have to like extract myself from it and let it go on its own. Baby's going off to college, and it's gonna have to deal with everything on its own now.
You're not gonna helicopter parent it.
I'm not gonna helicopter parent my book. It is up to everybody else how they feel about it.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I feel like there's
all
gonna
I
be
can say is that I am happy with it.
Yeah, I am too. It looks so good. All of the MDE stories are now officially turned in and are, if not in galley, then shortly to be galley. I'm so proud of them all, and every single author worked so hard. It's especially funny to me that I got to see Austin work on it up close and got to feel guilt. Like, I always feel bad if I have to give an author a deadline and I know that they're busy or whatever, but like this time I was like, oh, that's what that looks like. Sorry.
A lot of ramen is what it looks like. But I'm so excited. I'm so excited that Peter Darling has so many book siblings. It's fun to come out as part of a collection.
Yeah.
They're all very different books, I would say.
Yeah, they're very different.
I don't know. They're all
spiritual siblings, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're all so different, and they're all so wonderful, and all of the authors work so hard on them. But there is a really hilarious part of getting to witness the production of the book firsthand. other than on the other side of an email or whatever. But yeah, I also was going to say we should tally up the changes that were made to the book. If you've read the book, which I hope you have, if you're listening to this, good Lord.
Spoiler alert.
Spoilers. I remember us saying like, oh yeah, and this book is maybe going to have Hook POV in it. And then for a while it wasn't. And then it did again. And now there's like, what would you say the percentage of Hook POV is? 20%? 15%?
Yeah, I would say, I could actually probably in my head tally up how many words it is. It probably honestly like 10%. It's not much. It's the prologue and then two other chapters in the
book. We didn't have a prologue for a while. We did.
And then we did have a prologue, and then I moved the prologue to the middle of the book. If you've read Peter's first flashback in the book, that used to be the prologue, and I hated it. I hated it so much. I kept going back to the beginning of the... Every time I tried to edit the middle of the book, I would have this nagging, just anger at the prologue, and I would go back and line edit it and be like, maybe the prose is what's the problem. And then I finally was like, I hate where this is. But I can't cut it. And I moved it around.
And we ended up very deliberately choosing the Hook POV as the prologue because originally it was the first chapter. And yeah. And then I was like, well, I think you may have suggested it, but I definitely agreed, was maybe to differentiate between the POVs because it is primarily Peter, make Hook the prologue so you don't necessarily expect that this will be a 50-50 narrator split. So all of the Hook stuff is on its own. It's its own chapter. There's no back and forth within the chapter.
I didn't want people to get to the end of the first chapter and be like, and who the fuck is Peter? It's Peter's book. Hook is a huge part of it.
For sure.
It's not an equal share of the glory, for sure.
No, it's not. And I think it would have been a mistake. I mean, in as much as I'm the first person who told you to write Hook POV, I think it would have been a mistake to do a 50-50 split. I don't think you could have done justice to the fact that the book is called Peter Darling and it's about Peter if it had been 50%.
As somebody who is obsessed with narrative structure, I had to let go of the idea that if I was going to have another POV that it would have to be like a perfect 50% of the words would be in each character's point of view. I love me some structure.
I noticed that sort of stuff too. I'm super attuned to it. And I will mention this because I recently read the books, but so the Captive Prince series is entirely in Damon's POV except for literally a scene. It may be a chapter, but for literally
a
scene.
Two scenes. There's one in book three.
I was thinking of the one in book three, or am I not? What the fuck?
There's also the one in... Oh, no, there's two in book three. There's what? Also the one where Laurent is in jail.
Yeah, the one I was thinking of is the one where Laurent is in jail.
Yeah, and then there's the one with the woman whose name I can't pronounce.
Oh, no, because Damon witnessed that. Like, Damon followed him and saw all of that. It wasn't in Laurent's POV.
No, there is. Because when they're talking about her baby, not the one in the jail. The one later.
Oh, okay. I think you're right.
There's another, like, it's very short.
It pinged me because I'm a person who pays super duper close attention to how split POVs are. And I was like, wait a minute, this isn't Laurent's POV and there hasn't been much Laurent at all.
I think that Captive Prince honestly inspired me a little bit in terms of being able to step outside my structure because... In Captive Prince, like, there's no part of me that was like, I object to this structure. It was like, oh! Laurent POV.
I can
That's
do
exciting.
This.
That's exciting. That's exciting. Because I care about this. Okay, well, hopefully people will enjoy Hook enough as a character that they're not going to be like, what? They'll be like, oh, sweet. Now we get the other side of the story.
We get another.
Because we've been in Peter's head the whole time, and clearly there's more going on than that.
Definitely. And I was going to say, that is a great tie-in to the fact that one of the things you did in revision was you had read one of C.S. Picat's blog posts, sort of instructional posts on sustaining tension.
Yes. It was super, it came to me at, like, the perfect point in the book. It was honestly the most miraculous coincidental thing that happened in the process of this book. I can't believe I just coincidentally read that blog post at the right time in my life for it to change everything. C.S. Picat did a series on writing techniques that's really, I really highly recommend it. And one of the posts in it was how to resist catharsis for your characters and sustain narrative tension. It made me realize what had been going wrong with the middle of my book that plagued me forever. and that what I needed to do was suspend certain elements of the story, kind of fill out the ending as opposed to the middle.
What was it in the middle that you, I mean, be more specific.
I'm trying to remember, because part of it is that stuff shifted around. There was a lot less uncertainty in what it meant that Peter and Hook were both real people. That was something that they both had a kind of a mastery of after that point in the first draft.
They sat down and talked about it.
They basically sat down and hashed it out and were like, oh, well, that's what's going on. And then that, like, thread of tension just dropped because they both had this...
They were on the same page.
Almost meta-level understanding instead of, you know, still, I think, naturally being uncertain about what it meant for them to be in the world in this way. So that was one thing that I drew out. Some of it was about cutting elements because originally there had been a lot more violent hostility between them at that point.
Do you remember when you had to track how many wounds they had?
I sure did.
And you'd forget one occasionally.
All
you'd be
the
like,
time.
Oh yeah, that's right.
I cut out so many miscellaneous. I feel like, honestly, people hearing this are going to be like, what do you mean there was more violent hostility between them?
Oh, there
because
was
it's
way more.
Still, there was more. There was a lot more. Cutting those elements out and softening the tone of the middle meant that there was more tension to build. Ironically, it could naturally kind of build towards the ending. And there was other stuff I think that I'm forgetting, but they both realized that Ernest is a real person in the caves originally.
Yeah, the caves. The caves. TM capitalized, yeah. Uppercase.
One of the points where I just actively flew into a rage was when Amanda turned back in the list of overused phrases to me, and one of them was just in the caves. And I just was like, God damn it. Because that was just the story of me editing. It was, oh, in the cave, such and such happens. But yeah, originally, Hook knew that Ernest was a real person. And so that thread was just kind of tossed in there and dropped. And then there was no room for, I don't know, it was just kind of bland.
Poor there. Ernest got the shaft, really.
Poor Ernest. This is another thing that was, we wanted to talk about sort of last minute improvements to the book.
This one was all James, though.
This one was all James. James comes in and goes, hey, Austin, does Peter ever speak to Ernest again after Ernest, like, betrays him? No, why would he do that? And James was like, Austin, come on! And made me go back through and write their resolution, which was very important, and I'm very glad that they made me do that. I think part of what happens when you're dealing with a book for so long is that you just want it to be resolved, and so you're no longer like emotionally keyed in sometimes to stuff that like needs to happen and catharsis that needs to happen,
and you've tidied away in your head, like, you know,
yeah,
how that goes.
I know what's going on there, and so I was really anxious about my word count and about going over the word count for some reason, and I was really anxious about just getting the book done, and so for me I was like, oh no, nobody cares about that. And then James comes back and is like, what do you mean? Put it in there. James was a lifesaver, especially just fielding so many of my... They identified a lot of the problems, and then I scrambled to kind of figure out, like, okay, how am I going to solve all these things? And they were with me through the painstaking process of figuring out, like, where should I put it here, or should I put it there? Or should I put it there? They also, I want to just highlight some of the stuff that they made me put back in. Because the original Peter Darling was way more violent and way more overtly and uncomfortably sexual, I would say. There were a couple of moments of them kind of demonstrating possessiveness towards each other. And I cut a lot of that out when I kind of swerved in a different direction. And then James came in and was like, okay, some of that was important, though.
Yeah.
In recognizing the impact that they have on each other and the meaning they have for each other. The bit where Peter tells Hook that Hook is his was one that James was like, put that back in the book. And I was like, okay. I also wound up writing so many extraneous sex scenes for this book. I know you wanted to talk
yeah.
about this.
this is where the shaming begins. Okay, so there are like a couple of things that I've shamed Austin about for this book. One was the talking fucking sharks.
Okay, the sharks are gone. I swear to God, we talked about this in the last
part. We did.
They're gone.
I brought them up just because I want to remind people that Austin thought that was a good idea.
Look.
The second one was the over-description of Hook's outfits and or eyes. Usually both kind of at the same time.
Which I dealt with by strategically agreeing to some cuts and then making as many outfits as possible essential to the plot.
Yeah, you're a fuckboy. and then the third thing was definitely me going, okay, where's the rest of the porn? Because those of you who have read the book, which should be all of you, know that there is one sex scene. And guess who has an orgasm in that sex scene? Peter. Guess who doesn't? James. Me.
You have something to say about that?
Why that? Why not more?
Here's my social justice answer to that question.
I don't want your social justice answer. I want you to answer that to the people who are just like, wow.
Here is my problem. In the scope of the book, there was not room for another sex scene. The only place that I could have seen myself adding another sex scene was like a porn epilogue.
I know.
I wasn't gonna. And mostly because I would have had to, the thing with the two of them is like, I know that they go on to have the kinkiest, most LARPiest sex lives of any two humans on this earth, but it's something that I feel earnestly like they would have developed over years. They just don't have the emotional stability or safety at the very end. They're very kind of raw, both of them. That the only way I could have justified putting in another sex scene was if it had been like a big time skip and then just boning.
Mm-hmm.
Just straight a time skip to Bone Town. And while I would have had fun writing that, it wasn't really in the scope of the book.
No, it wasn't. But you haven't accounted for the fact that James didn't have an orgasm.
And that's because I honestly think it's kind of cool that not everybody's got to come. It's not necessarily... I mean, I
can't make fun of you for that because I did the same exact thing in one of my short stories. So
yeah, I know.
Maybe you understand my desire for reciprocity.
I see James Hook as a... I didn't mean to say his full name. I just felt the need to clarify because my editor...
I know! James. After that, I was like, oh.
Yeah, I see Hook as somebody who is very cerebral about sex and doesn't really care that much about what's going on for himself physically.
That's it. I mean, I agree with you 100%. I just feel like, why God? At God, why? I'm real mad that we couldn't get the porn epilogue because it wouldn't have fit. Like, it would, there, no. If you had written it, I would have said we're cutting that. So.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I did write it. I wrote, like, not to, I feel bad. I'm just gonna torment people. I did write the porn epilogue, but I did. I wrote two extra sex scenes, and none of them fit because they were a part of their relationship that we don't get to see in the book. Because the book is very much like the fairy tale arc.
Yeah.
That ends at the beginning of the happy ever after. And them fully being, like, comfortable with each other happens later.
You can always release those in some other format in case people...
I'm planning to. Like, mostly because I've had a lot of fun writing them. And they're just... I feel like there's a promise of kink kind of embedded in the book that does not get to be explored.
No, unfortunately. I remember you coming up to me and being like, is there any way I can work like a flogging into the story? Like, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. Like,
no, not really. And it's just infuriating. I mean, there's a good chance it's out already by the time we put this out. Because I was planning on putting it out maybe sometime in February, March.
Yeah, if there's any separate material, I will link it in the episode description. What are you laughing at?
Abridge this and just be like, put in like a little voiceover. They're like, actually, there is porn.
If you want to read the porn, go to this URL.
There's some bootlicking. There's some role play and humiliation. They're insufferable kinky LARPers who live in the woods together, and all they do is paint, write books, and fuck.
True. It's real. And
hang out with their dog and cat that I've decided. All of these things I know about them. I know that they have, like, a dog and a cat, and the dog is named Jolly Roger.
Oh, God.
And the cat is named Tinkerbell. They're the worst people in the world. They're the worst people in the world.
We've talked about how they are the worst LARPers and role players.
Yeah.
Like, they are...
They're two of the characters I haven't really had this experience before. Writing characters who are, like, I love them, and I'm very attached to them. They're so annoying.
Yeah, if you knew them...
It would be so annoying.
In real life, you'd be like, these fuckers that I don't like.
Those people who live out in the woods, and all they do is dress up as pirates day in, day out.
I'm just imagining you trying to play a D&D game with them and just being like, we're never inviting them back to
this home. No, because you would try, and they would be... I mean, they would be amazing role players. Like, they would have... such a depth of understanding of their characters, but they would be so much more intense than any other human
being. And pedantic.
Yeah, they would not follow the rules because they would be like, well, I'm sorry, that doesn't fit into my character's backstory. Like, they would be just the worst.
Can't DM them, you can't rein them.
Basically, I would say that a sub-thread of Peter Darling is that Neverland is trying to DM for Peter, and all he does is blow shit up and be like, okay, but yeah, I control the weather now. Neverland is like, oh God, go away.
Everything we throw at this boy, he just deals with. Oh, Peter Darling, you've come so far.
Yeah, and I wanted to the one thing that made me really happy about it that I just wanted to ramble about, because this is my episode for rambling about shit. Austin rambles about his own book. Anyway, was that I've mentioned at least 20 times probably that Diana Wynne Jones is my favorite author, and she writes books that have a lot of value in rereading, and while I don't think I'm anywhere near her level, I was really happy that I felt like this is one of the things I've written where I feel like there is value to reading over it again and seeing stuff that was hidden the first time. And that just made me really happy because I don't feel like I've been able to do that before. Reveals that will imbue other stuff with more meaning. Because I really like those are my favorite books that have some kind of like circular aspect.
When you come back around, you see stuff
you double back and go,
before.
Hey, that's why that's highlighted, or that wasn't even highlighted, but in the context of the ending, that has more meaning than it did. I feel like such a self-absorbed asshole.
Why?
Because all of this is me talking about my own book.
I mean, that was the entire premise of the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
The episode. Not the podcast.
The whole podcast.
That would be terrifying.
So in conclusion, we decided to add a new segment recently where we talk about whatever we've been reading. And this is going to be way out of sequence for our actual lives.
Completely.
What have you been reading now as of February 4th, Amanda?
Well, I just finished the Captive Prince series, crying. I read them in 6 hours because I hate myself. And so I finished that, but I've been reading, and I feel bad saying this because it's like a drinking game. I'm reading Wanted a Gentleman by K.J. Charles, and I'm reading Tamara Allen's book, which I do not remember the name of. Where's my phone? So I am also reading Tamara Allen's book Downtime, which is actually quite old. I think it was published in 2007.
Ancient.
Yeah, it might as well not exist if it was published in 07. But I'm reading those things, and I'm enjoying them, and I have so many unread books on my Kindle that I kind of cry every time I open it, and I'm the worst person. Austin, what have you been reading?
I just finished Documenting Light by E.E. Ottman, which was a really important book, and it had a lot of stuff on working class trans experiences and trans historical identities that was really cool. So that was neat. I just read the epilogue to the Captive Prince books and cried the entire time.
It's really fresh for me.
I just started reading Show Yourself to Me by Zan West.
Oh, nice.
Which is queer, kinky erotica, and is also very emotionally intense. Very good.
I mean, my next book that I want to start reading is Not Your Sidekick, so.
Ooh.
And nice. I also want to read Documenting Light. It is on my bedside table, and it looks at me every time I get in bed. It's like, Amanda, pick me up. No.
And I just bought two new copies of The Picture of Dorian Gray, so I should probably reread it. Reread it soon.
I just bought the fucking series that I've already read 5,000 times and an Alex B. Croft novel that I probably have on my Kindle somewhere, but I was like, oh, this goes in my cart. It's gonna go on my bookshelf. We're the worst. I don't understand why we buy any new books.
Because there are new books all the time.
That's true.
All right, well, thank you for listening, everybody.
Thank you so much for going on this journey with us. For you, for you, it was just one podcast episode. For us, it was months.
So many months. And as always, if you would like to continue the conversation with us on Twitter, though I don't know why you would want to hear me talk about my own book any more than you already have, you can find us on Twitter. I'm at Austin Chanted.
I'm at Amanda H. Jean.
And that's our show, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Daria DeFore and Amanda Jean, with art by Keezy Young and music by Carly Ann Warden. If you want to continue the conversation, follow us on Twitter at TheHRPodcast, follow us on Facebook, check out our Patreon, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.